lead such an austere life because continued austerity would merely result in his death with his questions unanswered and his quest unended. He pondered upon that problem too, and he decided that what he had been doing was like trying to bail out the river Ganges with a sieve, or trying to tie knots in air. Once again Gotama pondered. He sat down beneath a tree, weak and trembling, with a weakness which comes upon those who have starved too long and who have but barely escaped from the portals of death. He sat beneath the tree and meditated deeply upon the problem of unhappiness and of suffering. He made a solemn resolve that as he had already spent more than 6 years in the search for knowledge without gaining the answer, he would sit in meditation and would not rise again until he had found the answer to his problem. Gotama sat, and the sun went down, and darkness fell upon the land, and the night birds began their calling and the animals began their prowling. Gotama sat. The long hours of the night dragged on and soon the first faint streaks of light appeared in the sky. The dawn was approaching. Gotama sat and meditated. All the creatures of nature had witnessed the sufferings of the weary Gotama the day before as he sat alone beneath the great tree. He had their sympathy, their understanding, and all the creatures of nature considered in their minds how they could help mankind struggle out of the difficult ways into which he had fallen. The tigers ceased to roar that their song and their callings should not disturb the meditating Gotama. The monkeys ceased to chatter, ceased to swing from branch to branch. Instead, they sat silent hoping, hoping. The birds ceased their song, ceased their trilling, and sat, instead, fluttering their wings in the hope of being able to help Gotama by sending to him waves of love and waves of cooling air. The dogs, normally barking and chasing around, ceased their noise and went away and hid beneath the bushes, hid where the rays of the sun should not fall upon them. The king of the snails, looking about him, saw the dogs disappearing into the shade, and the king of the snails thought how he and his people could help mankind through Gotama. Calling his people together, the king of the snails slowly led the way up Gotama's back, up his neck, and they clustered upon his sun-reddened head, that head so deep in meditation, that head so scorched by the burning rays of the sun. The snails clustered and with their cool bodies protected Gotama from the heat of the noonday sun, and, who knows, those snails by keeping Gotama's head cool may have helped him in his final quest. The people of nature at one time were the friends of man, they had no fear of man, and until man behaved treacherously towards them the people of nature came forward to help man. The day dragged on with Gotama sitting motionless as a carved statue. Once again the night came, the darkness, once again with the approaching dawn there came faint streaks in the sky, and then the sun brushed upon the horizon. But this time the sun brought Buddha enlightenment. As if struck by lightning, a thought occurred to Gotama. He had an answer, or a partial answer to the problems with which he had been beset. He had become enlightened with a new knowledge. He had become the awakened one, which in Indian is the Buddha. His spirit had been illumined by that which had occurred during his meditation on the astral plane. He had gained insight and he had remembered the things which he had seen in the astral plane. Now, as he knew, he would be free from the unhappiness of life on earth, free of returning to earth in the endless cycle of birth, death, and rebirth. He had gained a knowledge of why man should suffer, what caused it, what was its nature, and how it could be ended. Gotama from that moment became Gotama the Awakened, or, to use the Indian phraseology, Gotama the Buddha. Now he pondered again as to what his course of action should be. He had suffered and studied, and so should he just teach others or should he let them find out by the means by which he himself has found out? He worried, would anyone else believe the experiences he had undergone? But he decided that the only way to gain an answer to this was to talk with others, to tell them the good news of the enlightenment which had come to him. Rising to his feet, and taking a little food and water, he set out on the journey to Benares where he hoped that he would find five of those former associates who had left him when he was in dire need of assistance, who had left him when he decided again to take food. After a journey which lasted quite a time, for Gotama the Buddha was still weak from his privation, he arrived at Benares and he met the five associates whom he had been seeking. He talked with them, and gave them that which has come down through history as the sermon on the turning of the wheel of the law. He told his audience of the cause of suffering, of the nature of suffering. He told them how to overcome suffering. He told them of a new religion which is known to us as Buddhism. Buddhism means a religion of those seeking to be reawakened. So Gautama knew hunger, I thought. I knew hunger too. I wished that this teacher would have more understanding, for we boys, we never had too much to eat, we never had too much time to ourselves, and with his voice droning on long beyond the allotted time, we were hungry, tired, sick of it all, hardly able to take in the importance of what he was saying. The boy who had leapfrogged into the Indian teacher sat snuffling. His nose was obviously damaged, perhaps broken, but he had to sit there with his fingers trying to stop the flow of blood, trying to keep from enraging the teacher further. And I thought then, what is the purpose of it all? Why so much suffering? Why do those who have it in their power to show mercy, compassion, and understanding, why do they, instead, behave in a sadistic manner? I resolved that as soon as my guide came back I would have to delve more deeply into these problems which were truly perturbing me. But I saw with considerable pleasure that the Indian teacher was looking a little tired, looking a little hungry and thirsty. He kept shifting from one foot to the other. We boys sat on the floor, all cross-legged except me, and I had to keep myself as unobtrusive as possible. The others sat cross-legged in orderly rows. The teacher normally patrolled at our backs so that we did not know where he was from moment to moment, but this man, the Indian teacher, he was shifting from foot to foot, looking out of the window watching the shadows move across the ground, watching the hours pass by. He came to a decision. He drew himself up and said, "Well, we will have a recess. Your attention is wandering. You are not paying heed to my words. Words which can influence the whole of your lives and your lives for eternities to come. We will have a recess for 1/2 hour. You are free to partake of your food, then you will return here quietly and I will resume my talk." Quickly he crammed his papers into his leather bag. It snapped shut with a very satisfying click. Then with a flurry of his yellow robe he was gone. We sat rather stunned by the suddenness of it all. And then the others jumped to their feet with alacrity, but I had to climb up painfully. My legs were stiff, I had to support myself by leaning against the wall and more or less pushing one leg before the other. But, the last one out, I made my way down to the domain of the friendly cook monk and explained to him the position, and how I, an innocent one, was being punished as well for the sins of the others. He laughed at me and said, "Ah, but how about the young man who was dropping pellets of soot? Is it not the case that your karma is catching up? And is it not the case that if your legs had not been damaged you might even have been the ringleader?" He laughed at me again, benevolently. He was a nice old man. And then he said, "But go on, help yourself. You don't need me to help you, you've helped yourself long enough. Have a good meal and get back before that awful man loses his temper again." So I had my tea, the same as I had had for breakfast, the same as I had had for lunch, tsampa. The same as I should have for years, tsampa. We Tibetans do not have watches nor clocks. When I was in Tibet I never even knew of the existence of a wrist watch, but we were able to tell the time by something within us. People who have to depend upon themselves rather than upon mechanical contraptions develop some different powers. Thus I and my fellows were able to judge the passing of time quite as accurately as those who wear watches. Well, before the half hour had ended we returned to our classroom, returned cautiously, as quietly as the mice which fed so well upon our grain down in the storerooms. We entered in an orderly procession, all except the boy who had a bleeding nose. He, poor fellow, had gone to the infirmarian where it was found that he had broken his nose. And so I had the task of presenting to the Indian teacher a cleft stick in which was wedged a piece of paper, bearing the reason wherefore the boy, now a patient, could not be present. The others sat, and we waited, I standing with my back against the wall bearing the stick in my hand, idly fiddling with the fluttering paper in the end. Suddenly the Indian teacher appeared in the doorway and glowered at us, and then he turned and scowled at me. "You, boy, you. What are you doing there playing with a stick?" he asked. "Sir," I replied with some trepidation, "I bear a message from the infirmarian." I extended the stick in his direction. For a moment it looked as if he had not the faintest idea what he should do, then suddenly he snatched the stick with such a jerk that I almost fell on my face. Dropping the stick, he took the paper and read it. As he did so his scowl deepened, then he screwed up the piece of paper and flung it away from him, a grave offense to us Tibetans, for we regarded paper as sacred because it was through the medium of paper that we were able to read history, and this man, this Indian sage, had thrown away sacred paper. "Well, what are you standing there gawping for?" I looked at him, and gawped more, for I saw no sense in the way he was going on. If he was a teacher, then I decided I did not want to be a teacher. Roughly he motioned for me to get out of sight and sit down. I did so, and he stood again before us and started to talk. As he told us, Gotama had found a different way of approaching reality, a way in which was called the middle way. The experiences of Gotama had certainly been twofold: born as a prince with the utmost in luxury and comfort, with an ample supply of dancing girls, the Indian teacher's eyes grew wistful, and all the food he could eat, and all the pleasures he could absorb, then from that, abject poverty, suffering, reaching almost to the point of death by privation, starvation. But, as Gotama readily understood, neither the riches nor the rags had the key to man's eternal problem. The answer must therefore lie between them. Buddhism is often regarded as a religion, but it is not a religion in the strict sense of that word. Buddhism is a way of life, a code of living whereby, provided one follows the code precisely, certain results may be obtained. For convenience, Buddhism may be called religion, although to those of us who are true Buddhist priests, religion is the wrong term. The only term is the middle way. Buddhism was founded from the teachings of the Hindu religion. The Hindu philosophers and religious teachers had taught that the way to knowledge of self, knowledge of the spirit, and the tasks confronting mankind were as one walking along the edge of a razor where the slightest leaning to one side or the other would cause one to topple. Gotama knew all the Hindu teachings, for he was at the start of his life a Hindu. But by his own perseverance he discovered a middle way. Extreme self-denial is bad, it leads one to a distorted viewpoint. Extreme indulgence is equally bad, for it equally leads to a distorted viewpoint. One can with profit regard the conditions as those existing in tuning a stringed instrument. If one over-tightens the string of an instrument, such as a guitar, eventually it reaches breaking point so that the slightest touch will cause the string to snap, and there is, therefore, in this over-tightening a lack of harmony. If one releases all tension on the strings of the instrument, one again finds that there is lack of harmony. One can only get harmony when the strings are correctly and quite rigidly tuned. That is as it is in the case of humanity, where indulgence or over-suffering causes lack of harmony. Gotama formulated the belief in the middle way and worked out the precepts whereby one can attain happiness, for one of his sayings was, "Happiness he who seeks may win, if he practice the seeking." One of the first questions which a person asks is, "Why am I unhappy?" It is the question most often asked. Gotama the Buddha asked why he was unhappy. He pondered, and thought of the thing, and thought around the thing. He came to the conclusion that even a newborn baby suffers. A newborn baby cries because of the ordeal of being born, because of the pain and lack of comfort in being born and leaving the comfortable world which it knew. When babies are uncomfortable they cry, and as they grow older, they may not cry but they still find ways of giving voice to their displeasure, to their lack of satisfaction, and to their actual pain. But a baby does not think about why he cries, he just cries. He just simply reacts like an automaton. Certain stimuli cause a person to cry, other stimuli cause a person to laugh. But suffering, pain, becomes a problem only when people ask, "Why do I suffer? Why am I unhappy?" Research has revealed that most people have suffered to some extent by the time they are 10 years of age, and they have also wondered why they have had to suffer. But in the case of Gautama, this question did not arise until he was 30 years of age, for the parents of Gautama had done everything they could to stop him enduring suffering in any form whatever. People who have been overprotected and overindulged do not know what it is to face unhappiness, so that when unhappiness eventually is thrust upon them, they are not in a position to deal with the matter, and often they have a mental or nervous breakdown. Every person at some time has to face suffering, and face the reason for suffering. Every person has to endure physical, or mental, or spiritual pain, for without pain there could not upon earth be any learning, there could not be any purification or driving away of the dross which at present surrounds the spirit of man. Gautama did not found a new religion. The whole of the teaching of Gautama, the whole of Gautama's contribution to the total of human knowledge, is focused on or about the problem of pain or of happiness. During his meditation, while the creatures of nature remained quiet that he might meditate unmolested, and while the snails cooled his sun-heated head, Gautama realized pain, realized the reason for suffering, and came to believe that he knew how suffering could be overcome. He taught these things to his five associates, and the things he taught became the four principles upon which the whole of the Buddhist structure rests. They are the four noble truths, with which we shall later deal. The shades of night were falling, darkness was descending so rapidly that we could scarce see one another. The Indian teacher loomed against the window, his outline limned in the faint starlight. He continued talking, forgetful or uncaring of the fact that we boys had to be up for the midnight service, we had to be up for the 4 o'clock service, and then we had to be up again at 6 in the morning. At last he seemed to realize that he was getting tired, he seemed to realize that standing there in the darkness with his back to the starlight he was perhaps wasting time because he could not see us, he could not know if we were paying attention, or if we were sleeping as we sat. Suddenly he slapped his hand on the lectern with a resounding thwang. The noise was shattering, unexpected, and we all jumped with fright so that there must have been several inches of air between our bodies and the floor. Then we all fell back with dull, soggy thuds and grunts of surprise. The Indian teacher stood there for a few moments. Then he just said, "Dismiss," and strode out of the room. It was easy for him, I thought, he was just a visitor. He had special privileges, there was no one to call him to task. He could now go to his cell and rest for the whole night if he wanted to. We had to go to temple service. We climbed stiffly to our feet, and I was the stiffest of all. Then we stumbled out of the dark room into the darker corridor. It was not usual for our classes to be held at such an hour, and there were no lights. The corridors were familiar to us, however, and we trudged along until we came to one of the main corridors which, of course, was lit by the inevitable flickering butter lamps, the butter lamps which were set in niches in the walls at head level, and which it was the constant task of two monks to keep filled with butter and to tend the wick which floated on the surface of the liquid butter. We stumbled on, up to our dormitory where we fell upon the floor without more ado, trying to gain a little sleep before the trumpets and the conches should call us to the midnight service. Chapter 4. I crouched below the great ramparts, making myself into a tightly curled ball while I tried to peer through a slight opening. My legs were raging, searing bars of fire which, I was afraid, would erupt blood at any moment. But I had to stay, had to endure the discomfort of lying cramped and frightened while I tried to scan the far horizon. Here, in my present position, I was almost on top of the world. I could get no higher without taking wings, or, the thought appealed to me, being lofted by some mighty kite. The wind swirled and howled about me, tearing at the prayer flags, moaning under the roofs of the golden tombs, and every now and then blowing a rain of fine mountain dust on my unprotected head. Early in the morning I had stolen out and with fear and trembling made my secret way through used corridors and passages. Stopping to listen every few steps, I had with extreme caution at last emerged upon the sacred roof, the roof where only the inmost one and his very closest friends were free to go. Here there was danger. My heart throbbed anew at the thought of it. Here, if I were caught, I would be expelled from the order in the most dire disgrace. Expelled? What should I do then? Panic welled within me, and for a long moment I was on the point of fleeing down to the lower regions where I belonged. Common sense prevented me. To go down now, with my mission unaccomplished, would be failure indeed. Expelled in disgrace? What should I do? I had no home. My father had told me that home was home no longer to me. I must make my own way in life. My wandering eye caught the sparkle of the happy river, sought the dark boatman in his yak hide boat, and my mind cleared. That's what I would do. I would be a boatman. For greater security I edged along the golden roof, safe now even from the sight of the inmost one, should he venture out in this wind. My legs trembled with the strain, and hunger rumbled within me. A patter of rain solved one problem. I bent and moistened my lips on a small pool that had formed. Would he never come? Anxiously I scanned the distant horizon. I rubbed my eyes with the backs of my hands and stared again. There was a little cloud of dust from the direction of Perai. Forgotten for the moment was the pain in my legs, forgotten too was the ever-present danger of being seen. I stood and stared. Far, far away a little group of horsemen was approaching along the valley of Lhasa. The storm was increasing, and the cloud of dust raised by the horses' hooves was whipped away almost as soon as it was formed. I peered and peered, trying to shield my eyes from the cutting wind and still not miss anything. The trees were bending away from the gale. Leaves fluttered madly, then broke away and raced wind-borne off into the unknown. The lake by the serpent temple was no longer mirror placid, seething waves surged along to break madly against the far bank. Birds, wise to the ways of our weather, walked cautiously to shelter, always keeping head to wind. Through the strings of prayer flags, now almost breaking tight with the pressure, came a direful thrumming, while from the great trumpets fastened to the roof below came hoarse bellowings as the wind ebbed and swirled around their mouthpieces. Here, on the very highest part of the golden roof, I could feel tremors, strange scrapings, and sudden splats of ancient dust driven from the rafters below. A horrid premonition, and I turned uneasily in time to glimpse a ghastly black figure rushing upon me. Clammy arms wound around me, choking me, striking me violent blows. I could not scream, I had no breath. A stinking black cloud enveloped me, making me retch with the vile odor. No light, just shrieking darkness, and smell. No air, just that nauseous gas. I shuddered. My sins has found me out. An evil spirit had attacked me and was about to carry me off. Oh! I muttered, why did I disobey the law and climb to sacred ground? Then my bad temper got the upper hand. No. I would not be carried off by devils. I would fight and fight anyone at all. Frantically, in blind panic and furious temper, I lashed out, tearing great chunks out of the devil. Relief flooded through me, and I laughed the high-pitched laugh of near hysteria. I had been frightened by an old goatskin tent, rotten with age, which had been blown at me by the wind. Now its shreds were being carried in the direction of Lhasa. But the storm had the last word. With a triumphant howl a great gust arose which slid me along the slippery roof. My scrabbling hands sought in vain for a hold. I tried to force myself tighter to the roof, but all to no avail. I reached the very edge, teetered, and fell feather-light into the astonished arms of an old lama who gaped open-mouthed at me as I appeared, it seemed to him, from the sky itself, borne on the wind. As was the way of the storms of Lhasa, all the tumult and commotion had died. The wind was lulled and now merely sighed wistfully around the golden eaves and played gently with the great trumpets. Overhead the clouds still raced over the mountains and were whipped to shreds with the speed of their passing. I was not so calm, though, there was much storm within me. Caught. I muttered to myself, caught like the biggest ninny in the Lhasa. Now I'll have to be a boatman or a yak herder. Now I'm really in trouble. Sir, I said in a quavering voice. Lama custodian of the tombs, I was. Yes, my boy, said the old lama soothingly. I saw it all. I saw you born from the ground by the gale. You are blessed of the gods. I looked at him. He looked at me. Then he realized that he was still holding me in his arms. He had been too stunned with surprise to think about it before. Gently he put me down. I stole a glimpse in the direction of Perai. No. I could not see them now. They must have stopped. I. Honorable custodian. A voice bawled. Did you see that boy flying over the mountain? The gods took him, peace be to his soul. I turned round. Framed in a small hatchway was a rather simple old monk named Timon. Timon was one of those who swept the temples and did odd jobs. He and I were old friends. Now, as he looked at me and recognized me, his eyes widened in astonishment. The blessed Mother Dolma protect you! He exclaimed. So it was you. A few days ago the storm blew you off this roof and now another storm puts you back. 'Tis indeed a miracle. But I started to say, but the old Lama broke in, yes, yes we know, we saw it all. I came in the course of my duties to see that all was well, and you flew up over the roof before me. I felt a bit gloomy, so they thought a rotting old goatskin tent, tattered and frayed, was me. Oh well, let them think it. Then I thought how I had been frightened, how I had thought evil spirits were fighting me. Cautiously I looked about to see if any of the old tent was in sight. No, I had shredded it in my struggles and all the bits had blown away. Look! Look! Shrieked Timon. There's proof. Look at him, look at him. I looked down at myself and saw I had a string of prayer flags twisted around me. Clutched in my hand I still grasped half a flag. Clucked, and led the way down, but, I turned abruptly and rushed to the wall peering out again over the ramparts hoping to see my beloved guide. The Lama Minya dawned up, coming into sight in the far distance. But the far distance was blotted out completely by the raging storm which had left us and was now sweeping down the valleys leaving flying dust, flying leaves, and no doubt the remnants of the old goatskin tent. The old custodian of the tombs came back and peered over the ramparts with me. Yes. Yes. He said. I saw you come up the other side of the wall, you were fluttering in front of me supported on the wind, and then I saw you fall on the very highest pan of the golden tomb roof, I could not bear to look. I saw you struggling to maintain your balance, and I covered my eyes with my hand. A good thing, too, I thought, or you would have seen me fighting off the old goatskin tent, and then you would have known that I had been up there all the time. Then I should have been in for trouble. There was a babble of conversation as we turned and went through the doorway leading to the other buildings below, a babble of conversation. There were a group of monks and lamas, each one testifying that they had seen me scooped up from the lower reaches of the mountain path and lifted straight up, flapping my arms. They had thought that I was going to be crushed against the walls or blown straight over the potala. Not one of them had expected to see me alive again. Not one of them had been able to discern through the dust and stinging wind that it was not I being lofted, but part of a goatskin tent. I, said one. I saw it myself, with my very own eyes. There he was, on the ground sheltering from the wind and, poof! Suddenly he was flying over my head with his arms aflap. I never thought I'd see the like of it. Yes. Yes. Said another. I was looking out of the window. Wondering at the commotion, and just as I saw this boy blown towards me I got my eyes full of dust. He nearly kicked my face as he passed. That's nothing. Cried a third. He did strike me, nearly buffeted my brains out. I was out on the parapet and he came flying by me, I tried to grab him, and he nearly tore my robe off pulled it right over my head. He did, I was blinded, couldn't see a thing for a time. When I could, he was gone. Ah well, I thought, his time has come, but now I see he is still here. I was passed from hand to hand much as though I was a prize-winning Buddha statue. Monks felt me, lamas prodded me, and no one would let me explain that I had not been blown onto the roof but almost blown off. A miracle, said an old man who was on the outskirts. Then, oh, look out, here comes the Lord Abbot. The crowd respectfully made way for the golden-robed figure who now appeared among us. "What is this?" he asked. "Why are you so congregated together? Explain to me," he said as he turned to the most senior lama present.